You know, I've been thinking just recently about when we're young. When we're young children, we have assumed outcomes for good and bad people. And these outcomes are very clear in our minds. We see this as young kids play good guys versus bad guys, cops versus robbers. This morning I was listening in on a conversation between my kids where they were saying to one another, can you imagine a superhero movie where the good guys lost? Can you imagine that kind of movie? No, that would just be ridiculous. We have very clear ideas in our minds of what should happen to good people and what should happen to bad people. And when we come to a passage like Genesis 4, when we read of Cain and Abel, it's a disorientating read. It throws our senses. We sense that Abel was the good guy in the story. He was the one for whom the Lord had regard. And we sense that Cain was the bad guy. The Lord did not regard him. And yet what we find in the story is that Abel, being the good guy, ends up murdered. And Cain, being the bad guy, ends up under the protection of God. It's a bewildering thing to read when we are so well trained from our youth to have these clear ideas of what should happen to the good people of this world and what should happen to those we deem to be bad. And this story reverses those outcomes. The good guy is defeated, the bad guy is rewarded. And so we're asking this morning, what do we make of this? Why is this so? Why is this in the Bible? Well, to find our feet in this story of Genesis 4, we need to remember what got us to this point. What came before Genesis 4? The storyline, as we've been through the last couple of weeks, reminds us of a good God who created a good world for his people to enjoy. And yet through sin, this good world and this good relationship with God was corrupted. And what we find then in Genesis 4 is the continuation of that trajectory of the corruption of this world. Humanity sinking further and further into their corrupt nature. In fact, if you read Genesis 4 again, you will remember that we find in Genesis 4 the first record of murder. We also find the first record of someone marrying contrary to God's monogamous marriage design, someone who took two wives instead of what God appointed in Genesis 2 to have one wife. And then we also find that this man who took for himself two wives became the world's first tyrannical leader, the first one to impose himself on others with aggression and fear as he talked to his wives as he did. And so we just see the slide of humanity further into a corrupt state, contrary to what the Lord had idealized in Genesis 1 and 2. And this slide that we're talking about, this slide into corruption, is typified by Cain. He really embodies a lot of this chapter and the further slide into corruption. Along with his brother Cain, we'll just need to remember, along with his brother Abel, he knew that God existed. He was not agnostic about the existence of God. And along with his brother, they both sought a relationship with the Lord through a worshipful act. They both sought to relate again to the Lord through a worshipful act. So far, so good. It's a good thing to seek the Lord through worshipful acts. But we have to remember too that the story does point out for us that the Lord had regard for Abel's gift of worship, but not Cain's. And we need to spend a little bit of time just to think about that. Why is that detail in the passage? Why do we need to know? What is going on there? Why does God regard the one and not the other? Interestingly, this passage in the Bible does not tell us why. It just states it as a fact and moves on to tell the rest of the story. But the Lord has given us the rest of scriptures, which does tell us why Abel found favor with the Lord and not Cain. Hebrews, remember, tells us this. It says that by faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain. So it's that little detail that we're alerted to, that the act itself must be accompanied by faith. I draw attention to this because the Bible tells us that sometimes we can be doing the right thing towards God, but doing it the wrong way. Right? We can do the right thing, but we're doing it wrong. You understand what I'm saying? There's a little micro lesson here for us that behaving Christianly does not automatically mean that you are a Christian. Behaving and being are not always the same thing. At best they are. At best they are. They're true. That those who are really Christians, really want to behave like Christians. But if you turn that equation around, that is not always true, that those who behave like Christians are, in fact, Christians. And that is an important point that we are highlighted to in Scripture. And Cain and Abel's story highlights this very much, that though they both did the right thing at a heart level, they were not very different people. So Cain reminds us that there is such a thing as faking it with God. There is such a thing as faking Christianity, as faking faith, doing the right things, but internally there's just a void. There is no real heartfelt response to the Lord. And we see this in the life of Cain, don't we? He behaved like a worshipper of the one true God. He made his offering, which in itself is a good thing, but he was merely doing outward things. He was merely doing outward actions without true faith motivating those good works. So as a result of Cain faking it with God, it ultimately led to this spiral in his life, didn't it? We see this massive unwinding happening in Cain's life because of this superficial devotion that never really got to the heart of the man. Cain's rage at God's acceptance of his brother, but God's rejection of him, led to a murder which actually shows us how far Cain really was from God. In one moment he's worshipping and the next he's murdering. We can see then that his heart was not really toward the Lord. He was nowhere near God, nowhere near the character of God, as far as the heart level is concerned, right? Doing the right thing, but murderous in the next. So I want us together just to take a moment now to have a look at this spiraling rage in Cain's life. Because the story moves us, right? It tells us that Cain, he became discontented because of God's response towards him. And that discontent moves into a crazy plan to kill, and then that crazy plan gives fruit to the murder itself. And we want to have a look at that whole dynamic of moving from discontent all the way through to murder itself. It's a fascinating insight into the life cycle of sin. A very fascinating insight of how sin operates in all our lives. So let's have a look at this life cycle of sin. We know that Cain desired something, but he did not get what he desired. So if you look at verse 5, it says for us that, "For Cain and his offering, God had no regard, so Cain was very angry." This was Cain's unmet desire. He wanted acceptance with the Lord, but did not get it, and so he was angry. That is the first step in the cycle of sin. when we come up against unmet desires in our lives. It's interesting, later in Scripture, a man named James penned a letter, an epistle, and he said this about this principle. He said, each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire, and desire being the thing that you want but do not yet have. So the Bible alerts us to this, that where you have unmet desires, sin is lurking there. It is waiting for you. It wants to trap you in your unmet desire. Further still, unless that unmet desire is surrendered to the Lord, it will stir in us a wickedness. It will stir us up to wickedness. For Cain, his anger stirred up a plot to kill his brother. It wasn't accidental. It wasn't manslaughter in that regard, right? It was homicide. It was first degree murder. We see this start of this plot to go down this path of murder at the start of verse 8. When he lures his brother into this death trap, this text tells us that Cain spoke to his brother Abel, presumably to lure him out into the open, into a field where he could do this murder. So that's the second step on the life cycle of sin. We go from an unmet desire to this unsurrendered desire motivating or stirring up a plan to commit sin in our lives. And as this cycle continues in Cain's life, who had gone from an unmet desire to the anger to plot and kill, to the final step in the cycle reaching full maturity, Cain sees it through. He murders his brother, and this is the last step in the life cycle of sin. Sin will finally find an outward expression. Sin finally finds an outward expression. It's the way sin works. I labor this point because it tells us how it works in our lives. Sin is not merely doing the wrong things. Can we agree on that? Sin is not just, oh, I've done the wrong thing. You know, I've physically gone and done it. Sin has a whole backstory in our lives, a whole set of mechanisms that's at play and at work on your heart well before you even do anything. Sin is much, much deeper than that. It steers us in a direction away from God well before we even do the thing that shows that we are being steered away from God. It's so subtle, you know. If you think about how some sin acts in your life, it's just so subtle. We barely detect it. It feels natural that we would just do those things, those impulses that we find stirring on our hearts. That we barely even detect it. Until we finally give an outward expression to our sin, until we finally given in to those unmet desires and taken hold by folly, the thing that we have desired to be like, to need in our lives, that unmet desire. But I ask you at this point of Cain's life, isn't it gracious of God to at least make Cain aware that he is that life cycle of sin is about to activate in his life? Isn't it gracious of God to at least make him aware? Look, you are about to go down a very, very poorly chosen path. And God makes him aware of this, right? Before Cain drives off the cliff of full-blown sin, God graciously makes him aware that he is going down that path. And the Lord says to him, why are you angry? What's going on in your life, Cain? There's an unmet desire. Why are you angry? It's a tremendously gracious thing that the Lord would make us aware of these things well before we actually commit the physical act of sin. Well, we know the story. Cain won't respond to God's grace. He won't receive the Lord. No matter how gracious it was of the Lord to put these judder bars or speed bumps in Cain's path before he heads over the cliff, Cain did not respond to the Lord, to the Lord's grace at that moment in his life. And Cain, as the story tells us, did drive right over the cliff of sin. He made a train wreck of it, right? And so my question for you this morning is, what now? What now? When, if we are like Cain, if we are ever like Cain and we just drive over the cliff of sin and we're like, oh, you know, I already have these desires, so I might as well just go and make a mess out of everything. If we are like Cain that way, what now? What will God offer us now? Right? I mean, we're in a real pickle. We're in a real mess. And we're just asking, how does God respond? How will God handle people who drive over the cliff? Well, the first thing that we see is that Cain does suffer consequences for his sin. There is no doubt of that. If you're following along, verse 12 tells us this, that Cain is further cursed in his work. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. So there's consequence number one. And he's banished even further than Adam and Eve was from the garden, right? The Lord drives him further still and says, you shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. So his work will be unproductive and he's banished. He's driven even further away. So sin, I just want to tell us, sin does have consequences. There is no way around that. That's a hill too tall, too high, I should say. Sin has consequences that we have to face up to. But I also want to quickly say, or hasten to say, that we also find that God shows a remarkable mercy towards sinners like Cain. God is tremendously merciful towards Cain. Wouldn't you agree if we just look at this story? Cain knew he would likely be murdered if he was going to spend the rest of his days wandering the earth like a character out of Mad Max, right? Just wandering around waiting for someone to just come and kill him. He knew that kind of life was not going to be a good one. Would not be well lived. And the Lord's not insensitive to this, you know? Cain had just murdered and the Lord's like, well, you're going to be a wanderer now. And he's like, the burden is too heavy. You've punished me too greatly. I can't do it. And what does the Lord do? How merciful is the Lord towards Cain who had just murdered Abel? God marks Cain with a protective pledge. Verse 15, the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. What kind of mercy is that from the Lord towards someone who had just murdered? To mark him with his personal protection and to spare him from the same misfortunes. We don't know exactly what that mark was. We don't know what it looked like, you know. Did he have some halo glowing on his head? We just don't know. Okay, we just know that the Lord marked him somehow, and others would recognize it as God's protection on his life. Even though he was a murderer. And so we come back to where we started this morning. We're asking, how do we account for this? How do we account for the fact that the bad guy in the story receives so much mercy, receives goodness from God? It really does mess with our moral compass, doesn't it? That the Lord would do good things to bad people. We ask, why would God do something that we ourselves would struggle to do, to show mercy towards a murderer? How do we account for this? Well, this is how Christians account for it. Christians see in the Bible a doctrine called common grace. Common grace. And what common grace teaches is that even toward the worst of humanity, the worst people that you can think of, God still offers and provides some degree of mercy, blessing, and goodness. That is a remarkable thing to recognize in our world, that the Lord remains merciful to people who do not deserve it, people like you and I. It's a remarkable thing. Jesus taught this very doctrine, right? Jesus said at one time, he said this, that God makes the sun rise on the evil and the good. He sends rain on the just and the unjust. And Jesus is just laying out that God is still good. He hasn't changed. We have. We have become the unjust. But God hasn't. He still showers his blessings. He still provides measures of mercy. To Cain, God offered his protection. So God dispenses a general goodness even to those we'd categorize as the worst people in this world. The fact that a murderer gets to draw breath is a sign of God's mercy. That they get to enjoy another sunrise is evidence of God's mercy. Why do I labor this point? We are meant to learn something about the way God handles sinners here in Genesis 4. We are supposed to see that though we are like Cain often, plotting our sin and executing on that plot, that the Lord is still merciful. He still is merciful. He handles us with kindness that we do not deserve. He handles us way better than we deserve. He gives us more mercy. He is disproportionate when he handles his when he gives us mercy, right? Disproportionate to the things that we do, think, say, all that sort of stuff. He gives disproportionate amounts of mercy to us in our lives. And that's the point I want us to be alert to in this chapter, the main point. That Cain, though surrendered to the sin of murder, was afforded mercy from God that was disproportionate to what he deserves. That is what we learn about God in Genesis 4. He is merciful. That said, as we look to conclude this morning, I want to say just emphatically to you that living under common grace as sinners, enjoying the general goodness of God, is no substitute for God's forgiveness. It's very important that you get this. Being recipients of common grace does not mean you are a recipient of forgiveness. If we know ourselves to be sinners, our hope is not in the measures of common grace that we detect in our lives. Even Cain's story won't let us settle there. It won't let us just be oh, well, we must be okay because God is sort of good to me. You know, my life's okay. Things, the wheels aren't falling off. I must be okay with God. The story won't let us settle there. The story won't let us settle with common grace as our hope. It will push us towards salvation grace, that which God desires for his people. Have you noticed how this story ends, right? I mean, we've just plummeted from murder to Lamech, who's this tyrant. Where does the story end in the chapter? The story ends where God's grace is reignited. His salvation grace, his story of salvation grace is reignited. Cain's legacy, his family tree, however corrupt it has become, does not have the last word in that chapter. There is another legacy. There is a different family tree with another story to tell. There is Seth. There is another brother. And his family line tells us of a time where people began to call upon the name of the Lord. There's a glimmer of salvation grace that shines on the horizon of that chapter, though it has become very dark by the time we get to Lamech. The glimmer on the horizon tells us of Seth, another brother. And through his family, there was a time where people began to call upon the name of the Lord. And so though while it's not explicit, it does hint at a greater grace from God. That God is not content with common grace towards people like Cain. He is working to dispense salvation grace. So let me just say it this way. Just because things are going okay in your life, and we can detect measures of grace, common grace from God, does not mean that we have forgiveness with God. We may, but that is something that is settled at a much deeper heart level of faith in Jesus. Do you love Jesus? Do you trust Jesus? Do you bank on him for your forgiveness, your eternity with the Lord? Regardless of the common grace that you see in your life, you don't have to be a Christian to experience God's common goodness. But you do have to be a Christian to experience salvation. So don't settle for common grace. Look and long and embrace the greater grace of salvation, where forgiveness and new life is found through Christ.